Hi, and welcome to Online with USU. I'm Dan.
And I'm Alexis.
And today we are talking about Grit again by Angela Duckworth. We're into our part three. We're talking about chapters on purpose and hope. And so if you have done your reading, excellent. If not, you'll go ahead and get a quick synopsis here as we go through it. Remember, part of grit is not just the resilience and the perseverance, but also what you're aiming for. And so that's what she really gets into in these chapters on purpose. And so, Alexis, what are your thoughts on when it comes to purpose? I mean, what's your experience been?
I think that purpose is really hard to find in life. Like, you can find so many things that you think are your purpose, and then something just like hits you. I think that probably my journey was I thought that my purpose for the longest time was English teaching. And when I was in high school, like sophomore Alexis, just kind of went through her life thinking that that's what she was going to do. And I put so much work into that. And I did like journalism in high school and did like English Sterling Scholar and like all these things so that I could like build to that goal. And then I got to college and I started doing it. And I loved it. I really did. But it was like 90% right.
Yeah, it wasn't quite all the way.
Exactly. And I think that purpose is when it's just, it goes beyond you wanting to do it. It goes beyond just an infatuation or a love for something, but it's almost who you are,
mm-hmm.
down to your core.
Yeah.
And then you can make that like a marketable skill. And that's what I've done with what I do now, public relations.
Yeah. I love the way that in this very first paragraph that on the chapter purpose, she says that, you know, interest is one source of passion. Purpose, which she defines as the intention to contribute to the well-being of others, is another. And so, you know, yeah, just like we talked about when it came to our passion, you know, whether passion versus practicality and how passion is really kind of to build and develop, purpose is developed the same way. It's not just an inspiration out of the blue. It's the culmination of a lot of different work and putting thought and effort into these sorts of things. You know, for myself, like we've talked about previously, I was also looking at teaching, and then really found my passion and purpose in the university setting, helping students from the sideline. It's really funny. I went to I was on the other side of the job fair for my son's school. They had a bunch of people there talking about their jobs. You know, letting the elementary school kids learn what kinds of careers and jobs are out there. And I described myself as Alfred from Batman.
I love that.
It's funny because despite the fact that my full name is written at the bottom of every one of my emails, I've had people refer to me as Mr. Alfred. They read my name wrong, Alred.
Yeah.
And they call me Alfred. And it's happened so often that even my on my Steam username is a picture of Alfred from Batman the Animated Series that I grew up watching. But, you know, for me, I'm Alfred because Batman couldn't be Batman without Alfred. He couldn't be as kick butt as he is without having Alfred as his right-hand man, as his butler there. And that's what I am. I am the person to help other people achieve their educational dreams, to help them be the best bad A person they can be.
Yeah. I love that. And how does that relate to how you found that passion?
I mean, it just like when we talked about previously about passions in general, it was gradually over time. You know, maybe not finding it was over time, but identifying it as my passion and purpose was developed over time. It wasn't so much that I didn't like helping people and then liked helping people. It was, oh, this is something that I can do as a career, and this is what I really derive satisfaction from. You know. So I love the story that she talks about Cat Cole talking who was a role model for purpose-driven grit. And I thought it was so funny. She started off working as a waitress in Hooters.
Yeah.
And currently, or at least as the time of this writing, she was the president of Cinnabon. And in talking about her journey, Angela lays out about how she went from being a server to there being a bad night where one of the cooks just up and left. And out of an interest to, one, make sure she got her tips by making sure her customers got their food, two, being curious if she could work in the kitchen, and three, just wanting to help out, you know, make sure that things were running smoothly, she dove behind the stove and cooked orders and ran them out and stuff like that. And how from there, she went from there to later training everyone in the kitchen. She basically learned every job in that place over the course of a period of time. And within, I think it was, she started working there when she was 18. And then by the time she was 22, she was running a department of 10. By 26, she was the vice president. And as a member of the executive team, she helped expand the franchise to more than 400 sites in 28 countries. And it was all from a desire to help out. And she talked about how she got that desire from her mother. And I mean, that's the great thing about having a purpose of that selfless purpose, looking to others, is there are so many ways you can do that and so many different skills you can use.
I completely agree. And I think as well that a huge part of that for college students is looking for help from other people as well.
Yeah.
Like finding mentors who can help you, finding connections in those around you so that you're already starting off as a college student, focusing on where your purpose actually is, which is others.
Yeah. And I think you mentioned, you know, one of the best ways to do that is by meeting other people, finding mentors and stuff. Interestingly enough, my father has worked with had a coworker that has helped him both in the industries that he's been in. They're both into banking. They have different roles, but this is a guy he met in college. And I think if I remember, 3 of the 5 jobs my dad has held has been with this guy. And oftentimes it was this guy telling, "Hey Bruce, we've got an opening in our company. Come and apply here." And then telling his boss, "Hey, I've got this buddy of mine applying. You're going to be interested in him," you know? And of course my father had to prove his merits on everything.
Yeah.
But I mean, this guy, their relationship, which has changed my father's career several times, all in positive ways, is someone that he met in college, that they had a shared interest in finance and that sort of thing. And so, yeah, finding mentors, finding like-minded individuals can have a huge impact on your life. And college is a fantastic place to do it because you're in this place with lots of different people, lots of variety, lots of people you may not have run into in your normal social circles. And you're in these nicely defined majors that give you like, hey, you've got common interests in these things. You know, or even in my case, it shows you what you're really interested in, because I hung out with a lot of history majors and found out I don't think the same way that a lot of history majors do. I don't want to be a professional historian for my whole life. And that helped me in other directions. And actually meeting a guy, Brian Withchurch was his name, and he helped mentor me through student services and into peer advising. And I attribute a lot of my early success all of my early exposure to what I do now to him. And he was a guy that I actually met at work who just happened to be a graduating senior in my program. It was really kind of a fun experience, but I mean, that was all due to our situation. And so take advantage of the situation to meet all these people.
Yeah, I love that. And I think that it once again just links us to our goal of people, right? Like how, not thinking, I guess, what can I get out of this person, mm-hmm. if that makes sense? Because I think that that's a very, like, hard thing not to do sometimes.
A lot of people think of networking as, what can this person do for me?
Yeah.
But it really is the reverse. What can we do together?
Exactly.
Or what can I do to help them? I mean, we can pull the Kennedy thing on, you know, that's not what your friend can do for you, but what for you can do for your friend.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that that's, like, you can start early getting into people are my purpose, and people and their connections and my connections with them is what's going to propel us both forward, like you were saying.
Yeah.
And I think that that's kind of where we get into this bricklaying concept.
Yes, yes. I was just going to bring that up. Go for it.
Yeah. So in Duckworth's book on page 149, she talks about this concept of these 3 bricklayers who are trying to, I don't know, just like...
They're doing their job.
Yeah, laying bricks. and the first one, when asked what he's doing, he says, "I'm just laying bricks."
Yeah. He basically described what his job, or what his actions were doing.
Yes. And then the next one says that I'm building a church. And that's like his career, right?
Yeah.
Like,
He's got the big picture in mind.
Yeah, exactly. And then the last one says, "I'm building the house of God." And I think that that's... What's so powerful about that is that he's taking something that's so important to so many people, religion, right? And could potentially be important to them as well. We don't know.
Yeah.
And then making it a part of his career or his job.
Yeah, as she describes, it's the difference between job, career, and purpose, or job, career, and calling is what she refers to it.
Yeah.
Here. He understands not just the what he's doing and what it's going to turn into, but he's got a why. He's got a why to it, right? He's got the big picture, the ultimate big picture, and he knows the purpose behind it, right?
Yeah.
Going back to the second one, you know, I'm building a church. Okay, what kind of church? I mean, there's all kinds of questions you can ask there beyond that that he may not have an answer to. But building a house of God, that's such a specific thing that it's like, okay, that answer takes care of lots of the other questions there.
Yeah.
He's got this very definite purpose behind this. I mean, that's a wonderful demonstration of that. And I think that's fantastic. We talked about when it came to the deliberate practice about changing the way we experience things. And I think this is a fantastic example that we can do, because there's no denying these are three different experiences of these people doing the same job. And so even while we're practicing our trade, practicing our skills, as we find purpose, that will change our experience for there. And that may even be the answer to the question we had previously about, you know, how can you get enjoyment out of deliberate practice? It's not flow. Flow's the fun part. Deliberate practice is the agony. But with purpose, the deliberate practice doesn't become as arduous anymore. It's got a reason behind it, and you can take joy in that reason.
Yeah, and I think that big picture is so important for people to keep in mind. Like, I think a really good comparison is college, right? Like,
oh yeah.
I mean, who likes going and taking like huge study sessions or like doing
Gen
the busy
courses.
Work? Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like, nobody likes doing those things necessarily. Like, mm-hmm. they can see why there's value potentially. Mm-hmm. But nobody really is like, oh, I'm so excited to take this class, you know, or I'm so excited to study 5 hours for this test tomorrow.
Yeah.
But if you can take into comparison of like, why am I doing this? And why is this important to me? And how is this going to affect the people around me? Whether that be like, how is this going to affect my future family? Or how is this going to affect my like future lifestyle? How am I going to be able to help people around me? Like, whether you're being an architect or whether you're being a scientist, whatever, how is what you're doing now going to affect those later?
Yeah. What is the purpose of this?
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes the only thing we can see is the purpose of this is I have to take this class to take the next class, or I have to take this class to graduate. That's the purpose of this. You know, but if we can look deeper and find a more meaningful purpose, that will smooth the way a bit. It may not make the class easier, but it'll make it easier to do. Like,
yeah.
The work won't be any easier, but it won't be as arduous to your mental capacities.
For sure. And even like, how is this going to make me more marketable so that mm-hmm. I can complete my purpose, right?
Yeah.
Like, I'm taking this one class right now that, in all honesty, I don't think I'm going to use very often. When I went into it, initially, I was like, I'm a PR major. I don't need to know how to use mics. I don't need to know how to take video. Like,
I'll be hiring people to do this
for
me.
Yeah, exactly. Like, this is not my job. But it's honestly so useful now that I look back at it, because I think about now I can relate to the people who are around me. Like, the people I'm hiring, I can ask them questions that I know are actually applicable, right? And will test their skills. I also could be like, I could also do that by myself if something didn't happen, which makes me more marketable in my field.
Mm-hmm.
And that's led me to like take other classes, such as the entrepreneur class I've talked about in this podcast, of like, I'm not going to be an entrepreneur, right? I'm not planning on starting my own business anytime in my life. But I know that I can then relate to people who I will be associating with all the time.
Yeah. There is very little useless knowledge out there if you can just find the way to apply it. Just like you said, this is, you know, everything has got a purpose here, at least can have a purpose here. And I love how she actually does get into, towards the end of the chapter, she gets into how do we cultivate a sense of purpose. And she lists three things, or she gives three things from the different people that she's talked about throughout this chapter. So she talked about David Yeager, He recommends reflecting on how the work you're already doing can make a positive contribution to society. And that's kind of what you were talking about. You know, when we find ourselves in those classes that we don't want to take or we don't find interesting, thinking beyond, okay, beyond the here and now, how can this help me? How can this help society? That's kind of one of the first things we can do. One of the other things was thinking about how in small but meaningful ways we can change our current work to enhance its connection to your core values. When we find ourselves in arduous situations, oftentimes it's arduous because we don't see how it relates. We don't find out how it's, we don't see how it serves a purpose to us. But again, looking at, okay, it's not just about us, it's about others. And then seeing what kind of wiggle room we have when it comes to the actual tasks and those sorts of things. She actually talked about, with Google, and where they went in and talked with all the employees and did tweaking, as they called it, to see, okay, how can you change things within your job description so that you find more purpose in it? And then the last one she mentions is finding inspiration in a purposeful role model. And this is, mentoring is as old as everything, and it's really significant. I look back on my own professional growth, even my own social growth. I've mentioned my friend Ben several times. In many ways, he is a mentor to me. I think back on some of my old bosses, and I still refer to one of my great friends, Brad Watson, as my friend and mentor. He really was a professional mentor to me. And finding those role models can do so much, both in building our abilities, but also in carrying us forward in our purpose.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think that segues super well into the next chapter of hope as well. These three different things, right? Our values, our mentors, all of these things, that how can that relate to our drive?
Mm-hmm.
And I really like a quote that she says, which says, "I have a feeling tomorrow will be better," is different from "I resolve to make tomorrow better."
Yes. I've referenced my grandmother when it came to deliberate practice. This is another one of hers. She doesn't tell people to have a good day. She tells people to make it a good day.
I love that.
That's her sign off when she says goodbye on the phone, or when, you know, waving bye or whatever. She won't say have a good day. She says she'll tell you to make it a good
what
day.
What a lady. I love that.
She is a very amazing individual who is very, very selfless. I think I mentioned previously that when I was younger, I didn't fully appreciate her. I thought she was kind of scary because she was very straightforward, very strict in many ways. But it wasn't until I met a man that told me about how he appreciated her so much, because she would go and visit his mother every week and sit with her for a couple of hours and just chat, would read to her, all sorts of things. But he was just the first of dozens of people that I met that would tell me very, very similar things about my grandmother. And when I was in college, I would go every Sunday. We'd go over for dinner at her place. It was myself, my sister, and a couple of cousins. We were all in college together. And she just lives about a mile away from campus.
Oh, fun.
And before we would sit down to eat, she would hand me a cookie tray with a meal on it for the guy across the street, who his wife was receiving meals because she was very sick. But he didn't get any. He didn't receive meals. And so she made him dinner every Sunday and took it over. And wow. I did that every week for the 4 years that I spent in college.
Wow.
Going over to grandma's. And so she was a very, very selfless person. But yeah, there's a big difference between having a good day, making it a good day, and, you know, oh, tomorrow will be better, and I will make tomorrow better.
Yeah. And I think that what we talked about a lot in the last chapter really relates to that concept of people.
Yeah.
People make it worth it to continually strive, right? Like, if you only had a job to get up to the next day, it actually kind of reminds me of, have you seen the new movie Free Guy?
Yes.
So good.
Love that movie.
If you guys haven't seen it, you should go watch it. but I love it because at the beginning, he kind of has this crisis of like, my everyday is just going into this job that I don't like. And the only thing I really like about it is I get to be with my buddy every day. And then he ends up like finding this girl and going and kind of being the coolest. But I think that That's a really good example. Yeah.
He becomes cool for her.
Yeah.
He wants, and it's not just, he doesn't just want to like impress her. He wants to help her.
Yeah.
He, you know, hey, how can I help you with this? When you hit level 100, talk to me then.
Yeah.
So he goes and level 100 and says, okay, yeah. I'm here to help.
Yeah. Well, and he does it in a way that's unconventional. Like
he finds
the way that's best for him mm-hmm. to excel.
And he doesn't hurt people. So he goes and he helps people.
Yeah. And I think that that's kind of what we need to do with our purpose and having hope as well of like, find how you do it. Because mm-hmm. it's not going to be the same from every person around you. But I think that obviously that third principle that we talked about with cultivating purpose is so important, of having people to look up to.
Yeah.
Having people that like, they have given me reason to feel hope because they have so much hope, or because they help me excel in this thing, or I want to learn from them, or whatever your purpose is, whatever your values are, find what that is and then go for it full force.
We were talking before we started recording about this symposium I went to.
Yeah.
Life, the Universe, and Everything down in Utah County. Awesome symposium every year in February. But it's authors, illustrators, gamers, a lot of creative people. And over the times I've been there, over the times my family been there, you hear all these stories. You mentioned about how everybody does it their own way. And that is so true. I got to listen to somebody who became a storyboard artist and her journey to becoming that, to fulfilling that dream. I was talking earlier about the author James Owen, who I met and chatted with him, and like his journey is just incredible. I'm just getting into the bit of it. I bought his book and I'm reading through it, and it's just amazing what he did. But a lot of it was, this is something that no one's ever tried. This is something I want to do. We're doing it. And he made it work.
Yeah.
With great success. You know, it's different for everybody, and it's hard for everybody in their own ways. I loved her story about her what was it, her spring semester? The spring semester of her first year of college. So her second yeah. semester in neuro neurobiology. It was neuroscience. Neurobiology. It was neurobiology.
Oh,
she was
nice.
Enrolled in neurobiology. Yeah. And how she failed the first two tests, and the advisor, and is it bad that I related to the advisor on this one? The advisor's telling
no,
her,
you are an advisor.
You don't want an F in this class. Whatever you do, you don't want an F. It'd be best if you withdrew from it.
Yeah.
And she did the same thing that my wife told me she did with math. She's like, no, I am going to ace this, and I'm going to do this. Not only am I going to ace this class, I am going to major in neurobiology, which as an advisor, I'd be like, that's a little extreme. But you know, I'm hoping that as an advisor, I would have known her better. You know, as an advisor, you like to know your students. So that I wouldn't have been as judgmental as I was reading this. I'm thinking, what in the blazes? But no, it's, you know, pushing through, hitting those hard spots and pushing through is significant.
Yeah.
And I love the story. She talked about the dogs, about it was the researchers, Seligman and Mern. I know I'm pronouncing those badly. Seligman? Marty Seligman and Steve Mern, M-A-I-E-R. Anyway, they had this thing with these dogs where they would shock the dogs at random intervals, but of course there was a control group,
mm-hmm.
And then there was the focus group, which the focus group had a panel that they could push their nose against the panel and it would stop the shock earlier. So the shock would normally last a set amount of time, but if they pushed their nose against the panel, it would shorten that time. Well, then after going through that conditioning, they put them in a box called the shuttle box that the floor would electrify randomly. And there was a low wall that was about below their nose, I think is what it was. So it was a decent height wall for a dog.
Yeah.
But they found out that the dogs that had the panel, all of them, I believe it was all of them. Let's see. Would jump out. The high pitched tone would play, which would herald the shock, and then it would come through the floor. And nearly all the dogs who had control over the shocks the previous day learned to jump the barrier. They hear the tone and jump over the wall to safety. In contrast, 2/3 of the dogs who had no control over the shocks the previous day just lied down whimpering, passively waiting for the punishment to stop. And that what they learned, or what they derived from this, was that that suffering doesn't lead to hopelessness. It's suffering you think you can't control that leads to hopelessness. So the more you can influence your environment, or the more control that you can even just perceive of having, that's significant. That will give you more hope, and that will lead to more success.
Yeah, and I think that relates super well, once again, to purpose, like we were just talking about, right? Like, if you're having something that, like a class or a job or whatever, that could be related to being shocked in these things, like, that you can get past that. Like, you just need to, I think she dubs the term learned optimism.
Yes, yes, I did like that a lot. And it also reminded me of the, have you heard about the rats, the drowning rats?
I don't think so.
I'm going to see if I can find it here real quick, but it was another thing, psychology of resilience. Okay, I think I found it. Because I wanted to make sure I got the right number of hours. So what they did was they took a bunch of rats and put them in water and made them swim until they almost drowned. Right.
Oh wow. Okay.
And then they rescued them and pulled them out. Well, they pulled them out for only about 15 minutes. But then they put them back in the water and timed how long. I mean, so they ran them to complete exhaustion.
Yeah.
Gave them a 15-minute break, put them back in the water, and timed to see how long they would swim afterwards. And, like, oh, it was seriously, like, an order of magnitude greater than their original exhaustion point. I can't find the exact numbers here, but we're talking, like,
Significantly,
like seriously, maybe even two orders of magnitude. It was a huge amount.
Oh my goodness!
And it was because they derived from that the rats, knowing, having been rescued once, kept going because they felt that they would be rescued again. So the idea being that I'll be rescued again, I just can't stop until then.
Yeah.
But it was seriously.
That's really impressive. It reminds me of like challenges in Survivor that are based off of like perseverance. And I don't know if you've seen many episodes of Survivor or anything, but a lot of the time the people who you don't necessarily expect to win will win those. And it's all just for immunity so that you could stay the next week. They'll put themselves through hours of pain, potentially like hurting their body ongoing.
Yeah.
Right. But they do it because they have that optimism that I will be safe and that's what I need to be. And I think also a huge part that goes into that is positive self-talk.
Yeah.
And being able to like affirm yourself.
Oh yeah. That's a huge thing. I mean, going back to college students, math. Negative self. I went to a workshop one time that was taught regularly at one of the colleges I worked at, and it was on test taking in math specifically. The first half of the workshop was overcoming negative self-talk. The entire first half of the workshop was just on handling, overcoming negative self-talk. And then the second half was, here are some specific things you can do when taking tests that will help. But this was taught by one of our math instructors. And she's like, this is the biggest killer.
Yeah. Like even just saying something out loud of like, I am bad at math.
Oh yeah. Or I'm not a math person.
Yeah. Is like so linear. It's not allowing yourself to progress.
Yeah. My mother's a math teacher and she hates that.
Yeah.
She's a math teacher that loves English. She did English classes in college to stay sane from her engineering classes. she's like, nobody would ever say I'm not an English person. No one would ever say that. But for some reason, it's okay to say it about math. And it's no, that's just ridiculous.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, I mentioned James A. Owen. And I went and visited my mom's classroom a little while ago. And she had a quote from him on there. And it says, if you want to do it, no one can stop you. If you don't want to do it, no one can help you. And that's kind of similar to, I believe it's Henry Ford that was something, whether you say you can or can't, you're right.
Right.
You know, it's that same idea. There, you need to have a positive mentality.
Yeah. And I think that it's easy to not allow yourself to have a positive mentality. It feels easier a lot of the time.
Well, when things are going hard, it's really easy to beat up on yourself.
Yeah, well, and it's also easy to not give yourself the accountability, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you say that, oh, this math, I failed this math test, well, I just am not good at math.
Yeah.
That's such an easy way to like let yourself out of any responsibility.
Exactly, exactly. And none of us want to take responsibility for our failures.
Yeah.
I mean, because it's just inherent nature. We don't want to be the ones that, we don't want to be the ones that messed up.
Yeah. But why don't we want to be the ones that messed up? I think that that's a really good question. Like, why is failure seen in such this terrible light?
I just today, actually, earlier today, saw a video by, it was featuring a clip from America's Got Talent, Extreme. Mm-hmm. And it was, I can't remember his actual name. He goes by Wheels. He's a wheelchair BMXer.
Oh, cool.
The standard skate park type stuff in his wheelchair. He's got spinal bifida. And he went on America's Got Talent Extreme and was doing this ramp, going down the ramp, doing a flip and landing it. And I'd seen him, I think it was Devin Graham did a bunch of videos with him, and he is not afraid of wiping out at all. It's really impressive the beatings that he's taken.
Wow.
And in this clip on America's Got Talent, they took the judges up to the top of the ramp, and the judges they were seriously like safety lined onto the ramp. They felt so nervous. He goes down, mm-hmm. goes up, the fireworks go, everything, and he lands right on his face. Literally, like scrambling to keep his head up off the ground. I mean, just crawling. And everybody was just like, oh. And he's like, I got to do it again. I know what I did wrong. I over rotated. I'm doing it again. And they were like, are you serious? And Simon Cowell's sitting there, and he's like, you've done enough, man. Like,
yeah. Your face is broken.
Like, he had a full helmet on. He had a neck brace and everything. Okay. He had all the safety gear, elbow pads, the whole nine yards. The chair was strapped to him. I mean, the whole nine yards. He was safe. But they were all like, dude, you've done enough. You just ate it hard. And he told them, he says, the first one, the first one is always a trial. And once you go through that, yeah, you're probably going to biff it the first time, but then you know what you did wrong.
Yeah.
And he totally stuck the landing on the second one. I mean, totally and completely. It was just, it blew him out of their mind. And them coming down was just like, they were all nervous about coming down. And he just launched himself off this ramp on his wheelchair.
Yeah.
And they gave him the gold buzzer. He's going to the finals.
Yeah.
I don't know when that's airing and all that sort of thing. But I loved that idea about the first one's always the trial. You got to do the first one so that you can succeed at the other ones.
Yeah. And I honestly think that we're so afraid of failure because we're afraid of what other people are going to think of us. Mm-hmm. But in all honesty, I kind of think people don't care. Like, that sounds terrible.
I mentioned like the judges, they're like, dude, you don't have to do it again. You've done enough. That was impressive. That was incredible.
Yeah.
You don't beat yourself up over this, but you know, yeah, they can take, people take inspiration from failures, but we shouldn't let them, their opinions get us down.
Yeah.
But also we shouldn't settle for that either.
Exactly. Let ourselves expand, set our own precedents for ourselves that are higher than we think we can accomplish. Yeah. 'Cause why not?
Yeah. Going back, I mentioned James Owen and I mentioned his journey. His big moment for his career was him sitting on a park bench in January in Dublin, Ireland, after having sold everything that he and his wife had except for a sewing machine, books, and the dog.
Yeah. And can't even imagine.
Yeah. That was just to buy the ticket to get there.
Yeah.
So found a way home, launched a comic business, and achieved his dreams. And he's still achieving his dreams.
Which is so amazing. And I think it goes into her last point of hope, mm-hmm. really, of like rewiring our perspective, right? Like he was mm-hmm. following his dream when so many people were probably telling him, that's not a good idea. That's kind of ridiculous. Like, I mean, I would probably be among that group telling him that. But
go find a 9-to-5.
exactly. But I think that once we've dictated what our passion is, what our purpose is, it doesn't become a job, it doesn't become a career. And once again, it becomes this lifestyle. It becomes mm-hmm. a part of our very being.
I love the quote here from Bill McNabb. This is on page 186. He was a rower, Olympic rower. And he said, because I came so damn close to quitting and yet hung in there, and because things eventually did work out, I learned a lesson I'd never forget. The lesson was that when you have setbacks and failures, you can't overreact to them. You need to step back, analyze them, and learn from them. But you also need to stay optimistic.
Yeah.
I mean, and that really is, when you look at these paragons in many ways that we see of industry, of service, of their profession, that's a hallmark. Many of them, they're all optimistic. All of them are optimistic.
Yeah.
Because if you're too pessimistic, you don't succeed. You're not going to. She kind of wraps up on, let's see, where was it here? When you keep searching for ways to change your situation for the better, you stand a chance of finding them.
Yeah.
You have to maintain that level of optimism. You have to have that level of understanding. I'm not even going to say realism, but understanding that, yes, failures and setbacks happen. Let's learn from them. But you have to maintain that optimism. You have to maintain that hope.
And you have to be self-aware enough to know, like, where you're at and where you can go, I think.
Oh, yeah.
That this failure isn't who I am. Like, it makes me think of Simone Biles in the last Olympics.
Yes, yes.
Where, I mean, her taking out of her, like, last set, I guess is what it's called.
Yeah,
I think
that's what
it was. Was huge, controversial, right?
Mm-hmm.
So many people were upset about it. And I think many people saw it as a failure because she could have broken the record to get so many gold medals.
Mm-hmm.
But I loved her response of just like, I know myself.
Yeah.
Right? I know what I need and I know what my body needs. And that level of self-awareness, despite what other people are saying, is so important that, like, you have that inner optimism that she knows this Olympics doesn't completely matter. Like, it does. But
it matters, but it's not the be-all end-all.
Yeah. And what's the most important thing to me? Which goes back, obviously, like we were talking about, to what are your values?
Mm-hmm.
And finding what that value is and then just pursuing it despite what anybody says. But I wanted to ask you a question. How, in your opinion,
mm-hmm.
should college students find that balance of self-awareness and their own self-preservation almost?
Maintaining self-identity?
Yeah, while also focusing on others throughout your college career.
Got it.
What's that balance?
So really, how do we preserve our own, really in some ways, our own self-interest while not being selfish?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm certainly not an expert on this. I mean, as an advisor and such, they talk about me time, right? And I think that is important. Self-care, I think, is the important thing there, because self-care is not inherently selfish. Self-care is so that we can perform at our greatest ability. And as we move towards our purpose, that's to help others in many ways, right? In whatever ways that we are able to. And so I think that, you know, when they talk about mental self-care and physical self-care, that really is, that's important. It really is. And we shouldn't see that as being selfish, you know, but again, it all ties to purpose. Why are we doing this, right? It's so that we can be our best selves, so that we can do our best work for that purpose that we are pursuing. You know, I think that's the biggest thing. And trying to foster that in others as well. We shouldn't feel guilty about making sure that we're taking care of ourselves, so long as we're doing that for the reason. And you know, when we first start talking about purpose and talking about, you know, it's all about others, I think one of the best examples of this in fiction is Ebenezer Scrooge. I love The Christmas Carol. I read it every year. I watch multiple versions of it. And the whole point that Dickens was making was that selflessness and generosity will give you far more in life and do far more for society and for yourself than being a scringy miser. And one of my favorite lines in that book is when Jacob Marley comes to Ebenezer and talks about how his view of the world never extended beyond the walls of their counting house. And Ebenezer says, well, you always were a good man for business. And Marley's response is, business? Business? Mankind was my business. The common welfare, charity, forbearance were all my business. The workings of our counting house were just a drop of water in the comprehensive ocean of my business. And that really is what purpose is all about. We look at the things that we do on a daily basis. and it's the reasons why we do them that are important.
I love that. Thank you so much for sharing.
I love that story. I've been enjoying this book immensely. There are so many good things in here that we weren't able to cover. I think we've got one more episode that we're going to wrap up on it. So keep reading for that. But that'll take care of us for today. Remember, we're on all the social media, and we hope to see you around online.